In, backed by the powerful Countesses de Vile and de Gulpa, smarting from their defeat and narrow escape into Magies. They are pushing for the Anschluss, after which the Heroids and the Green Guards will wipe out to Magies and block the way to Wactus forever. The riots we are here to foment are simply a prelude to an all-out assault on Yaswata. We are pushing for a final solution. There can be no compromise. Even the memory of Yaswata must be destroyed as if Yaswata had never existed. After birth of dream. Smell of the salt marshes, slivers of ice at dawn, catwalks, towers, and wooden houses over the water where white-furred crocodiles lurk. There are many albinos in the city with hair white as snow and long slanting black eyes, all pupil, like black shimmering mirrors. Many of the inhabitants change color with the seasons being white in winter and changing in summer to a mottled green-brown. The summers are almost tropical and the marshes bloom with a rich profusion of flowering trees and shrubs along pools and canals. Here and there patches of swamp poppies with pods big as cantaloupes bursting with reddish-brown opium. It was a fall day, leaves turning, crisp frosty air. Most of the people were out in red hair and freckles, yellow, sepia, and orange. Naked with the spark boy in narrow stagnant streets. Saffron smoke curls out between his legs and fades to pale yellow and violet as the boy winks and capers away. When young Audrey woke up, the smell was still there oozing from the yellow cashmere blanket that covered his naked body. He closed his eyes, remembering the arrival in Badan, a shabby whorehouse district called Fun City where he had gone to meet his contact, the briefing from Dimitri during which he kept dozing off. Dreams in which Fun City became an arena for deadly sexual games, encounters with the Spark Boys, addiction to a radioactive drug known as the Blues, the clinic, the doctor. There was another body in the bed beside him. Opening his eyes and turning his head, he saw milky white skin, amber hair, and the face of an idiot angel. Toby. An English boy named Arn with a foxy, red face and a corrupt insinuating leer, Popper Toby, we calls him. When he gets in eat the smell of him pops you right enough. Bit of a lark, mate. Toby opened huge blue eyes and looked at Audrey, the pupils contracting. He kicked the blanket down and arched his body, stretching. The room is cold with a dusting of dry snow on the floor from the round opening in the wall that serves as a window. Audrey shivers, hugging his knees against his chest. Oh my! Arn stands at the foot of the bed in a red turtleneck sweater, green corduroys, and sandals. Just popped in to put some water on for tea. Arn then lights an alcohol stove and turns back towards Toby and Audrey, peeling off his sweater and pants. Coo! He says. A violet smoke pours from Toby's scent glands, blanketing Audrey's body with a smell of hyacinths, cyanide, and ozone. Audrey is choking, gasping, in a flash of violet light. Audrey sits up groggily. Where's Toby? Arn puts a hand on Audrey's chin, turning his head around to face a tarnished mirror on the wall above his bed. Mirror, mirror on the wall. A vertebra pops in Audrey's neck. Arn clicks his tongue. Audrey is looking into the vacant blue eyes of Toby, seeing the milky white flesh, larval and wraith-like, clinging to his body. Arn points to the mirror. Gor blimey, you shoulda eared I'm before we got together like. Right school tie he was. Arn says this in those clear penetrating upper-class English tones. You can hear every word 50 feet across a hotel dining room. You've eared of me, mit. Arn the voice. Absolutely breathtaking, said a gentleman from the Times and the Queen dropped E-R-H-C-H-E-S on TV. Wouldn't you? He tossed Audrey his underwear. Nip into your duds, love. Nobody is light for briefing. It's like rehearsals in showbiz. In the operations room, Dimitri is passing out photos and addresses for hit assignments. Arn is nowhere to be seen. Audrey is looking at the photo of the man he is to kill, a thin Italian face with protuberant yellow eyes glowing with sulfurous hate. Don't look at me! Screams the photograph. This will be a pleasure, Audrey thinks. I have not come just to look at you, you greasy worthless black market wop. Dimitri point to the map, right there. Runs a cigarette store. Smuggled stuff. Also an uncle, a broker, a buyer. Pays off in info to operate. He's got lookouts in this kiosk and this grocery store who report any strangers in the neighborhood. Two metal detectors, here and here. He's got another in the door of his shop and a sawed-off shotgun under the counter. You pick up your gun here after you pass the first two detection points. The detector in his doorway will be disconnected. A miniature youth, passing for an 8-year-old street boy, clicks his heels and bows. I am the disconnector. And you're just a dumb space sailor, Dimitri tells Audrey, looking to pick up a few cartons of smuggled cigarettes. He glances at Audrey's clothes, blue pullover, seaman's pea jacket, blue pants. And here's your hat. After you do the job on him, you walk out with your cigarettes and go to this Chinese laundry. They'll show you out the back way. In the street, Toby's face is an asset. With vacant blue eyes, yellow hair, and seaman's clothes, no one could look less like a dedicated and purposeful assassin. He pauses frequently, looking at a map of the city which he can't figure out how to fold up again, so he fumbles it together and stuffs the protesting paper into his pocket. Just a dumb fucking kid space sailor. Now he feels the eyes from the lookouts, probing, hate-filled, but not suspicious. Just the contempt of the angle boys for a mark, a crumb who work for a living. He drops his map and as he bends down to get it, pulls loose a brick from a wall and gets the gun. He can feel the lookout's eyes on his ass. Looks like a fucking fruit takes it up the farter. An old Italian hag leans over a balcony, ha ha ha, American. The gun is a snub-nosed 38 with cyanide bullets. He looks around, blushing, then opens the door of the shop and goes in. The man behind the counter looks at him. Audrey fumbles awkwardly and pulls off his hat. The man's eyes spit hate and contempt. What do you want? Audrey holds the cap by the visor, moving it across the counter within 2 feet of the man's chest. With smooth, fluid, casual movements, he draws the gun from his waistband and pushes it gently into the cotton lining of the hat. The vacant face of Toby ages and tightens, the eyes blazing into the Italian's face like a comet as Audrey smiles. Comprehension, then stark ugly fear, flickers into the man's eyes as he knows what is happening and knows it is too late to reach the shotgun. Audrey shoots 3 times through the chest, a muffled sound like a backfire in heavy snow. The man crumbles sideways, his eyes flaring out. Audrey reaches across the counter for a carton of cigarettes. He steps outside, looks around uncertainly and walks away. In the Chinese laundry, an old Chinese is ironing a shirt. He jerks his head towards the rear of the laundry. Audrey walks through into an alley that leads to a sort of mall in sunlight. A walk to the end of the world. Audrey was walking on a mall in bright sunlight. Ahead he could see mountains shrouded in mist, brightly colored food stands, tables under umbrellas, waiters in red uniforms. This could be a small resort in Switzerland. He was passing a huge marble snail, a bronze frog and a beaver. 14-year-old boys lounged on the statues in studied postures, eating ice cream and looking at each other, insulated from the passerby by some invisible barrier. Farther on, boys in cowboy boots, Stetson hats, and jeans posed in front of a clothing store with the same stylized unsmiling nonchalance, engaged in some timeless charade. A boy with white blonde hair sat on a stone bridge dangling his legs. Audrey turning into a paved courtyard and suddenly the air was oppressive and heavy with tropical heat. Youths in 18th century clothes lounge in cane chairs sipping rum punch. They look cruel and languid as they caress pistol butts in their belts with slow obscene movements. A private eye is talking to the bartender. What were you doing in Bill Gray's Tropico? It's an old western and Clem Snide is a fabled shouldist. The bar is full of black powder smoke, the smell of entrails, blood, and chili. The walls and roof fall in. A sweet dry wind rises from the southeast. Audrey with some last-minute purchases. Almost the same buckboard it is already take care of Meester once he gets up beside the boy and they start off down the road where the flint chips glitter in the sun. Ahead they see mountains shrouded in mist, the orange and purple sky glowing behind. He must have dozed off while he was walking, it's known as the walkies. You get it from space travel. You can walk and talk and get yourself around while you are sound asleep, living in a dream. The dream is made of your actual surroundings. So you don't bump into things. You just see them differently. A ragged street urchin falls in beside him for a fraction of a second. He glances sideways and knows it is one of the miniature youths, strong and quick as little cats. The boy flashes ahead, leading the way through mirrors and walls, through shops and urinals that open into squares where street acts are in progress, minstrels, Nawa drums, lutes, horns, zithers, tumblers, fire eaters, jugglers, snake charmers. All blurring together. Audrey is walking very fast to keep up with the youth's sorcerer's gait, past a platform where several boys are doing animal copulation acts as they impersonate cats, foxes, lemurs, and horses, snorting, whinnying, growling, whimpering. The spectators roll in the street pissing with laughter. Audrey is struck by the variety of garb and racial types that flash by like scenes glimpsed from a train window, Mongols with felt boots, 18th century dandies in silk pumps and breeches, pirates with cutlasses and patches, medieval jerkins and cod pieces, sharp smell of weeds from old westerns, boots and holsters, jalabas, togas, sarongs, and youths clad in a transparent fabric like flexible glass lounge about in the studied postures he had noticed in the mall, obviously there to be seen. Superb Nubians naked except for leopard skin capes and boots of hippopotamus hide, boys in tight rubber suits with smooth poreless faces like green-white glazed terracotta. Frog boys from underground rivers. The guide throws over his shoulder. Audrey notices that his guide and most of the other people he passes carry at their belts a tool like a little crowbar hooked at one end. Now a ripple passes along the street, actors and musicians are gathering up instruments and props behind them as the word moves from lip to lip. Hip. Heroid patrol. People are dodging into doorways, prizing up manhole covers with their tools, and scrambling down ladders into a maze of tunnels where the heroids do not dare to venture. Audrey follows his guide through twisting tunnels, past youths on roller skates, scooters, and skateboards. The tunnels open here and there into caverns where people live in stalactite and quartz houses and tend pools of blind fish. Up twisting iron ladders are Turkish baths, lodgings, houses, and brothels. Privies open into restaurants and patios. Down a rope ladder is a dusty gymnasium where boys are practicing with various weapons as they wait for an assignment, Jerry and Rubble Blood P.U., Cupid Mount Etna, Dalfar, Jimmy Lee, and the Katzenjammer kids, as we call the German boys. They drift over to greet him. How'd you make out with the ID? Easy and greasy and lots of fun, the look on his lousy wise guy face when he knew. It was tasty. Audrey sees a number of the little people climbing up and down ropes and swinging from rings with great agility. He is amazed to see that some of them have long prehensile tails and retractable claws on their feet and hands that enable them to scramble up trees like squirrels. As he watches, one boy drops 30 feet to the floor, lighting like a cat. The other boys are constantly trying to touch the little people, but they are skittish of contact, dodging away from outstretched hands or snapping with their sharp little teeth. All of them are expert assassins, deadly with knife and strangling cord, dropping on their victims from trees or roofs or climbing into seemingly inaccessible windows. They are also highly proficient with firearms, using a tiny revolver that shoots nail-like projectiles and a rifle that shoots poison darts with a range of 200 yards. The subtlest assassins among them are the Dream Killers or Benguto Boys. They have the ability to invade the REM sleep of the target, fashion themselves from the victim's erection, and grow from his sexual energy until they are solid enough to strangle him. Audrey finds Toby in the locker room, sitting naked and pensive on a worn wooden bench. He looks up absently and pats the bench beside him. Audrey sits down and they both stare vacantly at the wall for several minutes. Finally, Audrey asks, "Is Arne around?" Toby looks at him blankly from an empty space. "I never heard of it. This morning. Well, my scent glands are so potent sometimes people hallucinate," Toby tells him smugly. "Perhaps you dreamed up the whole thing." "Well, maybe." He puts his arms around Toby's shoulders, hoping to excite him so he will give out the smell, which is like exquisite perfumed poppers. Toby's cock begins to stir and stiffen as he stretches his legs out in front of him and leans back, looking thoughtfully at his toes. Two little people come in rubbing against his legs like cats. They give off a delicate sand fox smell that floats on the heavier male scents of the locker room like a pause café. A 13-year-old in the black suit and straw hat of an English public school. Fag sticks his head in and calls to Audrey. "The shrink wants to see you." He pushes his eyes up at the corners to make a Chinese face and adds in falsetto, "Chop chop." After a few general questions about space lag, the doctor asks with elaborate casualness, "Would you please tell me in your own words everything you remember about this Arne?" He glances down at a file in front of him. Audrey tries to comply, but he encounters blanks in his memory, like trying to recall a dream that hovers just out of reach on the edge of perception, skittering away as you try to grasp it, erasing memory traces with a little broom that fades out, in turn wiping away footprints in distant sand. The doctor leans across the table and breaks an ampoule under his nose. "Just relax now and breathe in deeply." Audrey finds himself on a table looking up at masked faces. "That's right, now count up to 50. When Audrey wakes up, he finds a shaved spot at the back of his head that is slightly sore to his touch. "Well, Audrey," the doctor explains, "we've installed a separator. Might come in handy if you ever need to be in two places at once." He pats Audrey's shoulders. "You can leave the hospital tomorrow morning. Now I'm going to give you an injection." The days seem to flash by like a speeded-up chase scene in a 1920s comedy. Patrols always behind them, bullets thudding into flesh, bombs in Middletown bars and theaters and restaurants. A wake of glass, blood, and brains, and the hot meaty smell of entrails remind Audrey of a rabbit he had once seen dissected in biology class. A girl had fainted. He could see her slump to the floor with a soft plop. Shatter day always closer. Moves and checks and slays. Like many riots, the Ba'dan riots began with a peaceful demonstration, but neither side had any intention of letting it end that way. The Anschluss with Yaswada was to be put to a plebiscite. Those most directly concerned, namely the inhabitants of the Kasbah, were disenfranchised. But they had obtained permission from the town council to make a peaceful demonstration in Courthouse Square, around which most of the government buildings were located. Meanwhile, Yaswadan agents were arming and organizing paramilitary forces in Middletown, intending to catch the Arabs, as they called them, between the Haroid police and the armed vigilantes and wipe them out. After which, they would demolish the Kasbah and drop poison gas down the tunnels and occupy Portland. Dimitri had his own plans. After delicate negotiations, he had made contacts in Portland. Portland officials are supposed to keep out of local politics except in cases of dire emergency. But the Anschluss posed such a threat to their continued function, if not to their personal safety, as to constitute a dire emergency, and all Dimitri asked was for a customs agent to look the other way for a few seconds when the containers of heroin for the Haroid police were being passed through customs, while Dimitri's agents substituted identical containers filled with a short-acting opiate antagonist. Dimitri also had promises of arms caches in the courthouse building provided by certain wealthy families who preferred to avoid more direct involvement. None of the old families wanted the Anschluss. It was a threat to their power, and Yaswadan agents were talking openly about parasites and traitors. Audrey knew the battle plan. Even if it went according to plan, there would be close fighting and heavy casualties. So he had these special cod pieces made up of a tough plastic-like material and issued them to his team, which was very good for morale. He was in charge of a commando group who were supposed to break through the line of Heroids like a football scrimmage, then race upstairs to a room in the courthouse where a cache of arms was to be waiting, and then take over the courthouse building. On the appointed day, the demonstrators from the CASPA, after passing a metal detector and a hand search for weapons, made their way towards the square past snarling middies. So many things could go wrong: the guns aren't there, they are in the wrong place, the keys don't work. As they filed into the square, he saw the line of impassive Heroids in front of the courthouse armed with 9mm grease guns. Sandbags and heavy machine guns on tripods were at the windows and on the roof. The provocation was carefully planted: crowbars and a stack of cobblestones from street repairs. Audrey glanced at his watch. 2 minutes to countdown. Muscular youths snatch up cobblestones. Jeers and catcalls explode from the demonstrators. Automatic weapons are raised. This is it. And something is happening to the Heroids. A composite groan is followed by the sound of emptying bowels and a reek of excrement. Instead of responding with deadly accurate machine gun fire, the Heroids are going down like tenpins as the cobblestones hit. So far, Dimitri's plan is working. On duty when there is no time for injections, the Heroids function on heroin capsules that dissolve at different rates, releasing a dosage every few hours. However, what is dissolving now is not heroin but a short-acting opiate antagonist. Withdrawal symptoms that would be severe enough spread over several days are compacted into minutes, resulting in immediate incapacity and, in many cases, death from shock and circulatory collapse. A boy throws a football block into a Heroid in front of Audrey. The gun flies out of his hand and Audrey catches it in the air. Now they are racing from the gangway. Two Heroids in front of the main door are trying to raise their weapons. Audrey gives them a burst as he runs past. A heavy iron door. The key works. Now down the gangway. Side door is open as it should be. Upstairs, and this must be the room. Key works, and there are M16s, ammo, grenades, and grenade launchers, and a few bazookas. The Perrys he knows are equipped with the older and more cumbersome M15s, and some even with Garands. Immediately Audrey's team spreads out in groups of five to take over the gun emplacements in the building and on the roof. Audrey and four others fan into a room. A machine gun is on a tripod behind sandbags. The crew, sprawled on the floor and over the sandbags, is completely disabled. Two are dead. Audrey kneels beside a young Heroid who is lying on his back, his deathly pale face covered with sweat, his pants sticking up at the fly. Audrey whips out a cigarette containing a quarter grain of pure heroin and injects it into the boy's arm. Now the second part of Dimitri's plan is going into effect: the conversion of the Heroids. This is why he did not simply substitute a quick-acting poison for the heroin. The boy sits up. "Welcome to our cause, comrade," says Audrey. The first shots in the area signal the Perrys, under the command of General Darg, to pour out of side streets into the square, where they expect to catch the fleeing unarmed demonstrators on the flank. Instead, they run into a hail of machine gun fire from the demonstrators who have seized weapons from the fallen Heroids. Even deadlier sniper fire strikes down from the windows and roof of the courthouse. To conserve ammunition, Audrey's commandos keep their weapons on semi-automatic, making sure of a hit with every shot. In a few seconds, Darg's forces have suffered several hundred casualties. He hastily withdraws to seize and fortify buildings on the opposite side of the square and along the side streets leading into the square. He dispatches troops to cover the entrances from the CASPA and to patrol Fun City to prevent more men and weapons being brought into action. By the end of the first day, rioters are in control of most of the buildings on the south side of the square. They are, however, unable to open a passage to the CASPA. Meanwhile, there is much rejoicing in Yaswada. The courtiers are planning a torture festival for the captives, camping around in costumes, and, of course, there will be a prize for the most ingenious torture device. The tortured captives will be rendered down into the most exquisite condiments and sweetmeats, raw quivering brains served with a piquant sauce, candied testicles, sweet and sour penis, rectums boiled in chocolate. The Countess de Gulpa admonishes her courtiers to bear in mind that only the ringleaders deserve exemplary punishment. The rank and file will make useful slaves. Oh, many is so kind, coo the courtiers. Many is so kind. Reports are coming in. The rioters have been surrounded and will surrender in a few hours. These reports have been sent out by General Darg, who is certain of a final victory and does not want the Green Guards or, worse still, a regiment of useless courtiers getting in the way and tarnishing his glory. On the other end, the reports are further falsified to curry favor with the countesses. The Empress of Yaswata holds aloof from these rejoicings. She knows that whatever the outcome of the battle, her power is gone. She is, in fact, making plans to flee the city in disguise with a handful of faithful eunuchs. The Empress intends to leave behind a little present for the countesses, a basket of sleeping kundu. The dreaded kundu is a species of flying scorpion. The body is covered by neat sharp backslanting red spines. The jaws are razor sharp and designed for burrowing like a mole cricket's. The venom that drips from the hairs and the tail stinger causes instant paralysis. Then the kundu sheds its wings and burrows its way up body orifices and deposits its larvae in the intestines, the liver, the kidneys, and spleen so that the paralyzed victim is eaten alive. Unlike other scorpions, the kundu is diurnal, remaining comatose during the cold desert nights and being slowly roused to activity by the heat of the day. Perhaps I will win the torture contest in absentia, the Empress thinks. The second day saw substantial gains for the insurgents. The little people who can climb like monkeys, moving from roof to roof with their poison dart guns, carrying cylinders of chlorine and sulfur dioxide, flushed the Peris out of the buildings around the square, which were then occupied by the insurgents and the renegade heroids. Darg and his troop, however, remained in occupation of the buildings along the side streets and continued to block entrances from the Kasbah. Dmitri knew better than to attempt to force a passage through these narrow streets with troops on the roofs of buildings 5 and 6 stories in height, an error that cost the police heavy casualties in the New York draft riots of 1863. Then rioters on the roofs of buildings along the narrow streets of Lower Manhattan defeated armed police contingents with cobblestones and other missiles. General Darg, still sure of ultimate victory, even if a long siege was involved, refused to ask for reinforcements and sent back reports that the situation was under control. However, there were still a few pockets of resistance. The third day dawned like a bleary red eye. An old woman brought a basket of exquisite golden figs to the kitchen door of the Countess's palace. Under the figs, the kundu were still comatose from the icy chill of the night. Will Hollywood never learn? In Baidan, both sides are looking for a showdown. Darg, because he knows that he cannot conceal the actual state of affairs much longer. Dmitri, because he feels that a state of siege is not to his advantage owing to the numerical superiority of the enemy and their readier access to supplies and weapons. So both generals evoke every aid they can summon through magic rituals. As the sun climbs higher, the square looks like Hollywood gone berserk. Roman legionnaires under Quintus Curtius are fighting French riot police. Vikings and pirates battle crusaders and Texas Rangers. Old Western gunfighters shoot it out with the Black and Tans and Kenya Special Police. Hannibal's elephants charge a train of 1920s Marines on their way to protect the assets of the United Fruit Co. Battle cries and songs ring out. Peons with machetes decapitate lynch mobs, mucho bouncing heads, meester. Battle cries and songs ring out with grunts and bellows, war whoops, bagpipes, the reek of horses, chili, and garlic. La cucaracha, la cucaracha. Ya no quiera camina. Por que notion, por que le falta. Marijuana perfumer. Pancho Villa's men shoot down a helicopter from Operation Intercept. An army of Chinese waiters charge out of a false front chop suey joint with meat cleavers, screaming, fluck you. Fluck you. Fluck you. They reduce narcs and mafiosi to hamburgers. Poison darts from Indian blowguns wipe out a clan rally. Nigger-killing southern lawmen are hacked to pieces by naked Scythians on horseback. Audrey is in the very thick of it, changing costumes every few minutes. Now he leads a detachment of amok Malay youths with krisses against the Shah Savak. Next Audrey, on a great black horse in medieval armor, charges down the streets of Middletown skewering religious women and lawmen on his lance. Then he is a shootist with his custom-made 44 double-action revolver leading the wild bunch to break up an auto-da-fe in Lima. Now he boards a Spanish man-of-war with cutlass and laser gun. Machine gun bullets, poison darts, arrows, spears, boomerangs, bolos, throwing knives, cobblestones. Rockets whistle through the air, sharp smell of weeds and dry heat from old westerns, snow and ice with Viking ships, amok Malays trail muggy heat and jungle smells, pirates blow in with a sea wind and a whiff of rum and spices, pitchmen and camp followers spread out their wares, false front saloons, whorehouses, taco stands, carny booths with root beer and spun sugar, sod-roofed huts serving chicha, chickpeas and roast guinea pig, street performers passing around the hat and picking pockets. Pee under the shell, now you see it now you don't. Shift partners round and round Malay youths with krisses skewering religious women, shootist with custom-made Kenya special police in his nostrils, southern lawmen are hacked to Hollywood and gone, and a grinning boy passes around a bloody Stetson. Nominate your poison, gents. Klansmen clutch their throats and turn black. We don't serve niggers in here. Thunders the bartender. Take them outside because they stink. Take them to the nigger morgue. Boys in medieval cod pieces have set up a catapult. Roman soldiers break down doors with battering rams, impervious to the bullets, which break against clear classic light with a whiff of ozone. Raids and prisoners. Rape of the Sabina. Romans sweep in on a women's rally and carry the bitches away, screaming and kicking. An old Western posse is lynching a Neanderthal man, KGB and CIA agents bustle scientists and enemy agents into cars or sweep down and hook them into a silent chopper like actors pulled off stage, Inquisition police drag jet-setters out of cocktail lounges, and the green guards are busy with their nets. Oh, I want that one. Who's a courtier? Audrey leads an army of 12-year-old boys carrying banners of colored silk. Poltergeists of the world unite. They stand now, still as stone, in a sickening uneasy calm. As the barometer drops and drops, slowly a black cloud gathers over their heads. A little wind stirs brown hair across the mouth, brown lilacs and brown hair, ruffling through hair yellow as corn silk, through auburn, orange, russet and flame red hair and black pen curls. Wind. 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 A sighing sound, a whistle, a shriek, hair standing straight up now as a black funnel whirls around their slender bodies tearing cobblestones up from the street, screaming hurricanes of broken glass as the boys ride this bucking whistling wind it's known as a space horse. You let it carry you all the way out, glass blizzards stripping flesh from bones, tossing bloody bones through the air with street signs and branches, masonry, stones and timbers the whole city is flapping and shredding. Thousand-mile-an-hour winds the fences, barbed wire, and massive iron gates hemming in the caspa are tearing loose, flying wire decapitates screaming crowds. Pen, god of panic, rides the wings of death as the torn sky bends with the wind, prop sky tearing, shredding incandescent force the pure young purpose blazes like a comet. Wind. 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 Audrey is in the eye of the hurricane, a point of lucid calm. In front of him is a dusty tube of Colgate toothpaste in the window of a tangier shop. Far away he sees Middletown, red brick houses, a deep clear stream, some bridges, naked boys, high-pitched distant voices. A boy who looks familiar, he knows the boy's name but can't remember from where exactly, it's Dink. Dink Rivers, the boy from Middletown. Now Dink waves and beckons, it's me, Audrey. I'm back. Audrey tries to reach him but the wind tosses Audrey about like a cork. He is fighting his way upriver through breaking ice floes, years tearing loose. The distant voice of the pitchman, the age-old story of Adam and Eve. Audrey finds himself in the fun city of his dream, can't remember exactly. Pinwheels, shooting galleries, a rural slum, run-down houses, rubbish, little fields of corn and cabbage, blotched diseased faces, silent and intent, all moving down a steep road of red clay, no one seems to see him. The road leads to a rubbly square. In the middle of the square is a platform built around a tree. Argue second time. Around such a deal. On the platform is Arne as Eve with long red hair, her body covered with fever blotches. A naked youth with long yellow hair is Adam. The fever smell steams off their naked bodies and the crowd draws the smell in, whimpering and rubbing themselves. Something familiar about Adam, Audrey thinks. Reminds him of something a long time ago. Why, it's me. Now Arne proffers Adam an apple. The fruit is purple red and shiny like the head of a penis. Here and there on the fruit are triangular bulges like Adam's apples and at one end is a russet rectum. Why it's made of male flesh, Audrey thinks. No. No. Audrey screams without a throat, without a tongue. Adam does not hear. His face wears an appalling expression of idiotic ecstasy as he bites into the apple. Audrey can feel the sugary burning metal taste down to his quivering toes as Arne rises from his side tearing loose, the sweet diseased knowledge. Eve stands there with a noose, bone song burning marbled cream smashed roses, old story of Adam and Eve, how Eve was made. Knowledge of the blackout. Blackjack's apple tree, fruit made of the boy's death dangling there. It's a lovely tree, isn't it? Nets of the green guards fall over Audrey's head. By noon of the third day, General Darg is ready to surrender. Knowing the treatment meted out to defeated generals in Yaswata, he calculates how he can get a better deal from Dimitri. The insurgents are now in control of Ba'dan, or what is left of it. Considering the terrible fate awaiting prisoners taken by the Green Guards during the battle, Dimitri launches an immediate all-out assault on Yaswata. Audrey has been captured by the Green Guards and brought to the Countess de Gulpa's palace. She isn't going to share this with the courtiers. Hello, Audrey, I am very glad to see you here. She smiles and licks her lips, her eyes glowing with green fire. Let me show you around. Two massive guards flank him on either side and two walk behind. Through electrodes implanted in their brains they are telepathically controlled by the Countess. I'll show you my conservatory, Audrey. I'm sure you will find it interesting. She leads the way into a red carpeted room. There is a plastic sheet across one end where plants are growing. A horrible black smell of filth and evil fills the room, a smell of insects and rotten flowers, of unknown secretions and excrements. Come along, I'll show you my little plants. She stands at one end of the plastic screen, which is open and leads to a narrow path that encircles the garden. Look there, Audrey. Audrey sees a pink shaft growing from the ground, a penis-shaped shaft, red and purple, and as he watches, the shaft moves and pulses. The Countess leans forwards with a hoe and turns the plant out of the ground. The shaft is attached to a pink sack with insect legs like a scorpion or a centipede. It scrabbles to cover itself up with dirt. That was once a silly boy like you, Audrey, and that's where I'm going to plant you. The Countess stands with her hand on the door. You'll find out how it's done, Audrey. You'll have 6 hours to learn. The courtiers, lounging on a colonnade high above the river, see a flotilla of boats, rafts, and landing barges approaching. This must be General Darg returning in triumph with hundreds of captives. They squirm and moan in vile anticipation, stretching forth languid fingers to a basket of golden figs warmed by the noon sun. My God, something's up me. The principal defense of Yaswata are the towers, manned by a few skilled technicians, capable of throwing electric blasts like lightning bolts. Now the towers open fire, blowing boats out of the water. The insurgents take heavy losses but they spread out and keep coming. Landings have been made all up and down the river and Yaswata is surrounded by confused troops without a plan of attack. The Cyclops boys go into action. These beings have one eye in the center of the forehead. They can activate the death chakra in the back of the neck until a laser boom shoots out the third eye, cutting through stone and metal, seeking the electronic control centers of the city. Instrument panels are blowing out, magazines exploding. The screaming crowd pours through the walls, now broken in many places. Death to the Council of the Selected. Death to the Green Guards. Death to the Foreign Sows. Death to the courtiers. But the courtiers are deaf to everything but their own screams as the Kunda do their work. Audrey felt the floor shift under his feet and he was standing at the epicenter of a vast web. In that moment, he knew its purpose, knew the reason for suffering, fear, sex, and death. It was all intended to keep human slaves imprisoned in physical bodies while a monstrous matador waved his cloth in the sky, sword ready for the kill. From the depth of his horror and despair, something was breaking through like molten lava, a shockwave of uncontrollable energy. Audrey felt the chakra at the back of his neck light up and glow like a tiny crystal skull, brighter and brighter. A hum filled the room and a smell of ozone. The Countess turned from the door, eyes blazing with alertness, and Audrey saw what had happened. The orders to the guards had not been obeyed. An interfering frequency had blanked out her control of them. Audrey smiled and licked his lips. He started forward, hands outstretched to block a groin kick. The Countess screamed like an animal, dodged past him and out the door. He was a step behind her as she sprinted down the corridor. He ran with inhuman speed, taking 20 feet at a stride, and caught her at the end of the hall. He held his elbows piniwand, his hip against her, and grinned into her screaming face, which was losing all human semblance as he smashed her against the wall and threw his hammer fist into her face, crushing the perfectly chiseled nose and lips that crumpled like rubber. Now he was clawing out her eyes, which were blank and white and rubbery. Someone was shaking his shoulder. "Mr. Carsons, what are you doing?" "Why, you're waking up the whole ward." Audrey found himself looking at a ruptured pillow. A nurse stood over him. "Just look what you've done. You've torn your pillow to pieces." She snatched the pillow from his hands and bustled out. The nurse returned with a new pillow. She straightened the bed and put the pillow under his head in a way that said, "See that it stays there." She looked at her wristwatch. "I'll get you an injection." Audrey lay back looking at the ceiling. He felt calm and relaxed. He must have had a nightmare. He couldn't remember what it was, and it all seemed very remote and unimportant. Just a pillow. Well, he had a new pillow now. The nurse was back with a hypo on a little silver tray. He rolled back his sleeve, felt the alcohol on his arm and the prick of the needle. Gum 1/4 grain. He woke in gray dawnlight and lay there trying to remember. When had it all started? In London with Jerry Green and John Everson. His first real habit. He had chip-pied around in New York with cut shit, but this was pure H. Dispensed by a woman doctor with a title. The Countess, they called her. If she liked you, she would write for any amount of heroin and coke or both. She liked the boys. As she called them. Then, suddenly, the terrible news. The Countess was dead of a heart attack. The Home Office was clamping down. Time to move. So Audrey, Jerry, and John set out for Kathmandu in a second-hand car that got them as far as Trieste, where they took a boat arriving in Athens in the middle of the summer. The boat was like an oven. They finally found quarters in a hostel, a bare room with 3 cots. The proprietor had inquisitive, unpleasant eyes. Everything about him said police informer. But they were thin and the room was cooler than the street. The boys stripped to their underwear and sat down on the cots. "I feel terrible," said Audrey. "I got some kinda awful hives," said Jerry, scratching at a red welt on his ribs. "Probably just the heat and being sick," said John. "Let's see what we've got left." He stood up and swayed and put a hand to his forehead. Audrey stood up to steady him and silver spots boiled in front of his eyes. They both sat down again, then got up very slowly and took a little Chinese h and some cotton from the knapsacks. They cooked it all together and split it. 10 minutes later, Audrey was down with cotton fever. Teeth chattering, his whole body shaking, he lay on the bed, knees up to his chin, hands clenched in front of his face. Finally, he got two nembuddles down and the shivering stopped. He went to sleep. He dreamed he was back in St. Louis as a child. He was eating orange ice very fast for the sharp headache and the relief that comes from sipping a little water. Just as he reached for the water, he woke up with a pounding, searing headache, his body burning with fever. He knew that he was very sick, perhaps dying. He tried to get up and fell on his knees by Jerry's bed. He shook Jerry's shoulder. The flesh was burning hot. Jerry muttered something. "Wake up, Jerry. We have to get help." The door opened. The light was turned on. Three Greek cops and the proprietor were watching from the doorway. The cops pointed to the boys and said something in excited Greek. They backed out of the room, stuffing handkerchiefs in front of their faces. Leaving one cop at the door, they called an ambulance. Audrey vaguely remembered being lifted onto a stretcher by masked figures. As he was carried down the stairs, he saw words in front of his eyes, a lattice of black words on white paper shifting and rotating. He could make out the first sentence. "The name is Clem Snide. I am a private asshole." The nurse stood by his bed with a thermometer. She put it in his mouth and left the room. She came back with a breakfast tray. She drew out the thermometer and looked at it. "Well, almost down to normal now." Audrey sat up in bed, drank the orange juice greedily, ate a boiled egg and a piece of toast and was drinking his coffee when Dr. Dimitri came in. The face looked familiar and seemed to stir and concentrate the vague shapes of the dream. "Of course," Audrey thought. "I've been delirious and he was the doctor. Well, I see you're a lot better. You should be out of here in a few days now." "How long have I been here?"
10 days.
"You've been very sick."
"What was it?"
"Don't know exactly, a virus, new ones keep turning up. We thought at first it was scarlet fever, but when there was no reaction to antibiotics, we shifted to purely symptomatic treatment. I don't mind telling you it was a close thing. Temperatures up to 106, your two friends are here, exactly the same syndrome. And I've been delirious all this time. Completely. Do you remember any of it?"
"Last thing I remember is being carried out of the hostel. The remarkable thing is that you, Jerry, and John all seem to be in the same delirium. I've made a few notes." He flipped open a small loose-leaf notebook.
"Does this mean anything to you?"
"To Maggie's.
B.A. Dan.
Yaswada.
Wactus.
Nafana,
or Gaddis.
No.
Cities of the Red Night."
Audrey glimpsed a red sky and mud walls.
"Just a flash.
And now, there is the matter of my fee. My father will pay you.
He has already agreed to do so, but he has refused to pay the hospital costs, pleading his income tax.
This is awkward.
However, if you will sign an agreement to pay, your father suggests that you apply to the American Embassy for repatriation.
Asterisk.
The boys are at the reception desk of the hospital, signing papers. Dr. Dimitri stands there in a dark suit. Audrey looks around, something very strange about this hospital. For one thing, no one seems to be wearing white uniforms.
Perhaps, he thinks egocentrically, they are all waiting for us to go home so they can leave, but then another shift would be coming on. In fact, he decides, this doesn't look like a hospital at all, more like the American Embassy. A cab pulls up under the portico. Dr. Dimitri shakes hands with a rapidly disappearing smile. As soon as the boys are gone, he walks through a series of doors, each guarded by an armed security man who nods him through. He is in a room with a computer panel attached to a battery of tape recorders. He flicks a switch.
"The console will see you now." A black wooden slate on the desk said, "Mr. Pearson."
The consul was a thin young man in a gray sear sucker suit with an ascetic disdainful wasp face and very cold gray eyes. He stood up, shook hands without smiling, and motioned the three boys to chairs. He spoke in a cultivated academic voice from which all traces of warmth had been carefully excised. You realize that there is a considerable hospital bill outstanding. We have signed an agreement to pay. The Greek authorities could prevent you from leaving the country. The three boys spoke at once. Audrey, it wasn't our fault. Jerry, we got sick. John, it was. Audrey, a virus. Jerry, a new virus. He smiled seductively at the consul, who did not smile back. Altogether, we almost died. They rolled their eyes back and made a death rattle sound. The police found evidence of drug taking in your room. You are lucky not to be in jail. We're certainly grateful to you, Mr. Pearson. And lucky to be here like you say, said Audrey. He tried to sound impulsive and boyish, but it came out all slimy and insinuating. The others nodded in agreement. Don't thank me, said the consul dryly. It was Dr. Dimitri who put in a word with the police. He is interested in your case. A new virus, it seems. He looked at the boy severely, as if they had committed some gross breach of decorum. Dr. Dimitri is quite an influential man. Altogether, plaintively, we want to go home. I dare say. And who will pay for it? We will when we can, said Audrey. The others nodded in agreement. And when will that be? Have you ever thought about working? Asked Mr. Pearson. Thought about it, said Audrey. In an abstract sort of way. Said Jerry. Like death and old age. Said John. Doesn't happen to people one knows. Said Audrey, feeling like a Fitzgerald character. The sun came out from behind a cloud and filled the room with light. The consul leaned forward and spoke in confidential tones. For example, you could work your way home. There's a ship in Piraeus now that can use three deck hands. Any sailing experience? Reef the mizzenmast, said Audrey. Scuttle the bilge, said John. And pour hot tar on the companionway, said Jerry. Good. The consul wrote something down on a slip of paper and passed it to Audrey. When you get to the Billy Celeste, ask for Captain Nordenhals. The boys stood up and said in chorus, thank you, Mr. Pearson. They flashed toothpaste smiles. Mr. Pearson looked down at his desk and said nothing. The boys walked out. As he stepped out of the office, Audrey got a whiff of that unmistakable hospital smell. A young man in a white coat was chatting with a nurse at the reception desk. A taxi pulled up for them at the door. In the office, Dr. Pearson picked up the phone. Dr. Pearson here. Yes, no question about it. He picked up the slides and studied them. B-23 all right. The boy Jerry is obviously the original carrier. Active. Like a plutonium pile, there is, of course, the a delicate and sensitive question of differential racial or ethnic susceptibility, with further research, perhaps. Could not commit myself on the basis of present findings, theoretically possible, of course. On the other hand, uncontrolled mutation cannot be ruled out, sure. How can I be sure? After all, it's not in my district. Late afternoon in the cabin of the Billy Celeste. Audrey and the boys have just signed on. Skipper Nordenhals glanced down at the names. Well, Jerry, Audrey, and John, you have made a wise choice. I hope you are quite fit. Oh yes, Captain. I, sir. The doctor said we made a remarkable recovery. Good. We will be sailing within the hour. Tunis, Gibraltar. Lisbon for Halifax. Incidentally, we will be passing the exact spot off the Azores where the Mary Celeste was found in 1872, all sails set, completely undamaged, nobody on board. His green eyes glinted with irony and he smiled slightly and added, "The mystery was never solved. Perhaps it was just the basic mystery of life, Skipper," Audrey added cheekily. "Now you see it, now you don't. Minutes to go. We call ourselves the Destroying Angels. Our target is the rear end of Yaswada, if it could be said to have one. We feel rather like the Light Brigade. All the bad characters of history are gathered in Yaswada for a last-ditch stand," the Countess de Gulpa, heavy and cold as a fish under tons of gray shale, the Countess de Vile, eyes glowing, face flushed from the ecstasy of torture, the Ugly Spirit, the Black Abbot, and the Council of the Selected, all with their guards and minions and torture chambers. "How can we prevail against this wall of icy purpose? We got the message on the teleflash from B.A. Dan. Yaswada has completed nuclear device ahead of schedule. All out aid requested. We are still 150 miles from Yaswada. 4 days hard marching. We don't have that much time. We are here because of you. Woke up in the Silent Wolf Lope. There is the river. No sign of Yaswada. I must be above or below it. I reach the bank. Across the river I can see the rotting piers and sheds of East B.A. Dan. To my right is what remains of a bridge, the upper structure rotted away, leaving only the piles protruding from green water. I am standing where Yaswada used to be. The water looks green and cold and dirty and curiously artificial, like a diorama in the Museum of Natural History. A blond boy enters from my right where the bridge used to be, walking on the green-brown water. He moves with a stalking gait as if he were playing some part in a play, mimicking some actor with a touch of parody. The boy is wearing a white t-shirt with a yellow calligram on the chest surrounded by a circle of yellow light, rainbow-colored at the edges. He is wearing white gym shorts and white tennis shoes. A dark boy in identical white gym clothes is standing to my left on the bank at the top of a grassy hillock. He has planted a banner in the ground beside him and holds the shaft with one hand. The banner is the calligram in the rainbow circle stirring gently in a wind that ruffles his shorts around smooth white thighs. The blond boy walks up from the water and stands in front of his dark twin. The dark boy begins to talk in soft flute calls, clean and sweet and joyful with a sound like laughter, wind in the trees, birds at dawn, trickling streams. The blond boy answers in the same language, sweetly in human voices from a distant star. Now I recognize the dark boy as Dink Rivers, the boy from Middletown, and the other as myself. This is a high school play. We have just taken the west side of the river. This is the conquest of Yaswada. Good evening, our chap. A good crossing. Yaswada disintegrated. A slow insouciant shrug of rocks and stones and trees spreads a golf course along the river now several hundred yards away. Two caddies stand in a sand trap. One rubs his crotch and the other makes a jack-off gesture. Music from the country club on a gust of wind. Red brick buildings, cobblestone streets. It is getting darker. Dusty ticket booth. A sign. The Billy Celeste High School presents. Cities of the Red Night. I lead the way through rooms stacked with furniture and paintings, passageways, partitions, stairways, booths, cubicles, elevators, ramps and ladders, trunks full of costumes and old weapons, bathtubs, toilets, steam rooms, and rooms open in front. A boy jacks off on a yellow toilet seat, catcalls and scattered applause. We are in a cobblestone alley. I look at my companion. He is about 18. He has large brown eyes with amber pupils, set to the side of his face, and a long straight Mayan nose. He is dressed in blue and brown striped pants and shirt. I open a rusty padlock into my father's workshop. We strip and straddle a pirate chest, facing each other. His skin is a deep brownish purple-gray underneath. A sharp musty smell pulses from his erect phallus with its smooth purple head. His eyes converge on me like a lizard's. What scene do you want me to act in? Death baby fucks the corn god. We open the chest. He takes out a necklace of crystal skulls and puts it on. There is a reek of decay as he drapes me in the golden flesh of the young corn god. We are in a vast loft-attic gymnasium warehouse. There are chests and trunks, costumes, mirrors, and makeup. Boys are taking out costumes, trying them on, posing and giggling in front of mirror, moving props, and backdrops. The warehouse seems endless. A maze of rooms and streets, cafes, courtyards and gardens.